thanks very much for talking to me today, Alison. I want to start, at the foothills of this discussion. Can you explain why inflation is considered to be such an economic ill?
Well, inflation is a condition when prices are rising generally across the economy for goods and services. And what that means, if one's income isn't keeping up with the rise in those prices, then your money is buying less stuff. So, you know, people can sustain that in short periods of time, but a rise in inflation that's sustained and one in which wages aren't keeping up has pretty terrible consequences, clearly for workers, in that their purchasing power is eroded. They can't buy the stuff they need. The living standard's lower. We only have to think of the housing market situation to see what it means when your money can't, a salary can't buy, you know, a home in any capital city now.
Yeah.
Financial pressures, they increase on households because the cost of things go up and, you know, mortgage rates go up, so the cost of your debt increases. And then more broadly across the economy, it creates uncertainty for business, which obviously wants to invest in a climate where it knows it's going to make a stable return, and high inflation basically takes away that certainty and can lead to a cutting back of investment and production, which, you know, means throwing people out of jobs and, like, essentially makes the problem worse, because if they're cutting back production, that means we have less supply, less goods and stuff we need, and so you can get into a bit of a vicious spiral.
So why do you think the Reserve Bank, as a norm, decides that to hike interest rates up whenever we look like there's an issue about inflation? Why do they do that?
Well, it's been the inflation management regime of almost 50 years, which kicked off in the late 70s, actually off the back of the last major oil crisis in the late 70s, when neoliberalism became an ascendant project. And what that project was about was getting government out of the business of directly managing the economy, including prices and wages, and using its taxing and spending powers to basically manage the economy. And this new regime came in where central banks became these key figures, nominally independent of government, though they are public institutions. And they were developed to have this sort of single track focus on keeping inflation at a certain rate. They use interest rates as their lever, and it's their only lever. And what the logic is we make borrowing more or less expensive by setting the cash rate, and that the cash rate is how much it costs for banks to borrow from each other. And the aim is, by lifting or reducing the cost of borrowing money, essentially, you reduce demand. And so if people then have less money to buy stuff, or businesses have less credit to invest in expanding production, then the demand that people are, that's represented by what people are wanting, then aligns with the economy's capacity to actually produce those goods and services. And it's a fantasy, because it follows this idea of aligning supply and demand, and that there's, you know, some law that does this. But we see very clearly in the case of the Middle East crisis and the war, where in the case of a big supply shock, it's just totally ill fit for reality.
Well, obviously for working people, it's a double hit. They are paying large amounts of money for commodities, essential commodities. They are finding it difficult to deal with their mortgages, and their wages aren't going up.
Yeah, and look, isn't it convenient that when we hit major crises in the economy, capitalism has manufactured a way to make workers worse off? And not just that, it's not just paying for the costs of disruption, but it's also, you know, in the case that we definitely saw after the 2022 Russia-Ukraine conflict and COVID, and it will be the case now, that we have big risk of a wave of sellers inflation, where basically the profit motive of very large, powerful corporations means that they actually exploit this crisis to fatten their pay packets and send workers backwards. And you know, like you said, this double hit, it's actually already a triple hit because their wages, real wages, have not kept up with inflation. They're only just really recovering after the last supplier-led inflation wave. So their wages aren't keeping up. So they're already back. They're paying more at the, you know, at the checkouts, and for paying more for petrol. And then the bank comes along and says, actually, you have to give me an extra $450 a month because the US and Israel decided to bomb Iran and start a new war. And we're going to, you know, there'll be big, powerful companies that profit out of this. And yet we're going to find a way to steal more of your pay packet under the guise of actually fixing this absolute, you know, crisis that we face.
Well, it's about maintaining their profits, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in this is something that's airbrushed out of the mainstream economic discussion, is that, you know, supply and demand are just these like dispassionate technocratic forces, and that there are like no real major powers or interests in the organization of an economy. But companies don't get into, for-profit companies don't get into the business of producing unless they think they're going to make a profit. And so...
And in fact, they don't actually care what they're producing as long as they get the profit.
Correct, which is one of the big reasons why you need to get government and the public sector involved in delivering the stuff that can't easily be made, you know, for profit. But then going forward, things like dealing with major crises like climate change, it's just... You know, the market is always going to be slow or, like I said, dispassionate to actually solve big public crises and problems that we face together. And so definitely with this latest conflict, there are, I mean, look at the oil and gas companies. Some are going to be hit by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, but, I mean, Australian oil and gas companies are going to, they're positioned for some serious windfall profits off the back of this war, which is what's leading to increased calls and mobilization really to introduce a windfall profit tax of at least 25% on gas exports, so that, you know, we actually can get the revenue required to take the edge off of some of these cost of living hits on workers.
Let's go back to the profits before we go on to solutions. There's actual data that happened after the COVID crisis, which shows that, as you say, these large corporations created what was called sellers' inflation.
Yes, so this is a new term that's arisen principally, like a lot has been pushed through the work of Isabella Weber. She has put her steely-eyed focus on the organisation and the profit rates of companies out of the COVID pandemic, because obviously what we knew happened then was there was a real, the pandemic itself, the health crisis itself was a big shock to supply chains. But what happened on top of that technical hit was the relationships of the ownership of production got jacked up, because, you know, some companies obviously did very well, especially if they were producers of medical goods. And then after the 2022 Russia-Ukraine conflict, we saw energy companies, gas and oil companies, extremely improve their position. And they're already very high profit rates. They, you know, were able to cash in such a way that created, you know, what many people listening to this will remember was 13 rate hikes we had consecutively in Australia. That was off the back of a massive profit-led inflation wave after the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which was, you know, on our TVs and from our government, what we heard consistently was it was because of Russia's intervention into Ukraine that caused the problem. But actually, there was, you know, that was the original trigger, but it was powerful global multinational corporations who saw a crisis and they decided to make bank from it and cash in on it. And what we need from our government now is a protection against massive profiteering, which we know has happened. It's been documented and demonstrated in evidenced in research that this is now one of the major risks to making this wartime inflation even worse for workers.
And many times I think people believe, they feel aggrieved by what's going on in their ordinary lives. I mean, and it becomes unsustainable, as you've already pointed out. But there's this background lurking feeling that if this method of dealing with the crisis isn't done, like the increase in interest rates and allowing these profits to happen, that in actual fact, the whole system will fall apart. But that's not actually true, is it?
Of course not. I mean, I would say if we continue to hike rates when we know that there are, like, households are incredibly under the pump, because these rate hikes, they don't hit households equally, right? Like they hit about a third of all households with mortgages, who are more likely to be workers, more likely to be to be parents, to be raising kids.
And well, they wouldn't have taken the risk otherwise, to buy a house.
Yeah, exactly. And more likely to have then very high mortgages. And so people who are in their houses outright, who are more likely to be older and asset rich and wealthier in general, and actually highest consuming, they are untouched. In fact, their position improves. So it's this unequal, it's already we know that interest rate hikes are only hitting a certain proportion of households. So even on the central bank's own basis for managing inflation, it's technically not sufficient. And then if we wanted to deal with excess demand, so to speak, although what I'm saying is that an oil price crisis is a supply crisis. It's not a it's a supply inflation problem. It's not a demand problem. But I think in this time, we actually have an opportunity to recast the way that we manage inflation in a way that makes Australia more equal and does share the burden of what is very likely lining up to be a pretty painful hit that, we are only just starting to prepare ourselves for. Like, we know that petrol prices are, $2.20 to $2.50 a litre, and people have been feeling that now for a couple of weeks. But we are on the precipice of something pretty shocking, like pretty significant. I think we're going to see a pretty big increase in inflation. We could be hitting like recessionary territory, unemployment rising. And, Asia has already started rationing its fuel. It's put out work from home directions. It decreased speed limits by 10 kilometres. Like, we are maybe moving into the types of wartime inflation control measures which required rationing. And we're not there yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if we started talking about these measures, in the months to come.
And you argue that actually, and this is common, like when there's if you're a publicist, you're working out how to make your worst aspects your most positive aspects, this being a downturn that is unavoidable now that this war has been ignited, you argue that Australia must consciously plan for a more resilient, independent and prosperous economy by actually dealing with our dependence on fossil fuel and to use the government levers that will actually help ordinary people, like with childcare costs, that there should be government intervention and it should start governing for all of us rather than just for the business class.
Exactly. As I said at the start of this interview, almost 50 years ago, we started a new regime of inflation management. That's where central banks use their interest rates to slog workers, basically to blame them for inflation. I think we have to go now back to the types of measures we had in place before that regime was introduced, before neoliberalism, where government used its power to directly attack inflation at the source. And there are a number of ways that we can do that. I've put forward a bit of a kind of a multidimensional approach. I think in the very least, you've got to look at some pretty high cost items in a household budget and subsidize those immediately. Government did this in the case of the electricity rebates after the 2022 energy price shock, and it had a almost, I think, 0.8 percentage point impact on the total inflation. So I think we can introduce cost of living relief for electricity rebates. Free childcare is a massive cost. With those two, the cost of those two, I think, could be paid for through a windfall profits tax on gas companies, which has been talked about at a 25% rate, raises $17 billion. So it's not small beans. And then, you know what we had in the 1970s? We had something called a prices tribunal, and legislation was introduced that required where government managed a tribunal, and it investigated, tracked, reported on the prices of that corporations had set for their basics goods and services, and it required large companies to of a certain size, a certain turnover, to come to government and justify why it was increasing its prices. If there was found to be profiteering, there would be consequences, and those consequences were never strong enough in the last model we had. But if we had real genuine teeth, I think it could play. You know, it's the kind of protections we need now for Australian workers, but also for our businesses that are going to be depending on imports from global multinationals. Then I think, in the spirit of, you know, sharing the load, well, why don't we deal with the fact that the interest rate manoeuvre that we constantly rely on by central banks does only hit, you know, about a third of all households who are already incredibly under the pump. Why don't we introduce tax reforms that actually deal with high wealth, high consuming individuals who are concentrating their investment activity in places we don't want inflation, like the housing market? So if we actually had the capital gains tax concessions cut, which is being discussed in the upcoming federal budget, that could take investor demand out of new dwellings. And that would have an impact on making, obviously, houses potentially cheaper for first home buyers. Of course, construction costs are about to go up, but it could be maybe a counteracting measure to increase in housing prices. And then wealth taxes, which are something that's been discussed now internationally to deal with the free ride that asset holders get at the expense of workers and wage earners who pay more tax than them. I've proposed through the McKell Institute a model of a wealth tax on ultra wealthy landholders. It's called the Extreme Land Wealth Levy, and it would levy a tax on people who had land holdings over $20 million in value, and then a higher rate for people over $50 million. And it would include trusts and companies and the kind of the shady ways that very high wealth individuals structure their finances to avoid tax. I think these sorts of wealth taxes, they will then reduce demand, aggregate demand of people who are high consuming, very wealthy individuals. But it's also an opportunity to plan for our future that's more egalitarian, less unequal, and one in which, you know, the balance of power really between everyday people and asset holders, and then also, you know, powerful corporations, is much more in balance.
Mm. Are the government actually governing, I'd have to say?
One might say, yeah.
Yes, one might say.